I'm excited today to be able to share with you that Dr. John Ortberg is here, and I'm going to kind of do this a little bit more formally to begin with, just so you, some of you who don't know him and can at least get a little bit of a background who he is. He's held several pastorates. He's a prolific award-winning writer and something over 15 books and scores of articles and other things. Has his MDiv and PhD from Fuller, serves on the board at Fuller Seminary, as well as at Westmont. He serves on the Martin Institute of Christianity and Culture. He was a guest speaker at the Minnesota Prayer Breakfast not too long ago. And then currently, he has a daily, about 10-minute teaching segment on YouTube called Become New. And you just find it at becomenew.com. And I encourage you, it is an incredible way to hear teaching that can actually form your soul on a regular basis. And so that's really... really wonderful. But I really want to just get over that so I could just talk about the fact that John is a dear friend. So John, come on up. And what I wanted to share with John, come on. So you guys know, a number of you have been here. Every year we go together with about five of us out west, and we have been friends doing this for like 25 years. My friend Chuck is here as well, who the three of us grew up in Rockford, Illinois, so had known each other since about eighth grade. But I'm going to show you a few pictures, because this is where I really got to know John. And this is our first, there I am. There's John. There you go. And then that's our first week at Wheaton. Our last week at Wheaton, there is John, there I am, and there's Chuck down here. One of the other guys who's also a part of the group that comes on these is Tom Nicholas. So let's go to the next slide. You remember this sanctuary, anybody? Here, and it is John officiating at my daughter's wedding. So that was a special treat. The next picture, and you put these besties BFF stuff up there. Because he, you know, anyway, over in this corner, just there over here, here's John singing at our wedding. I don't know what you're drinking there. Anyway, let's go to the next one, because this is one of my favorites. This is when we were together with guys. We were out, I think, by Half Moon Bay fishing or something like that, and we each caught salmon, and I just, if you look at it there, it's not, look at that, that's mine right there. I think it was one of the second largest out of, they measure those things or whatever, that spring. Last one is where we go. Here's the ocean back here. This is where we kind of spend those weekends away. So, John, we ended with a sunset. And thank you so much for being my friend. Thank you for being here. Love you.
Well, I was not prepared for that particular introduction. But I... I'm very, very more grateful than I can say for Kevin's friendship and impact on my life, and am glad for all of you that you get to have him as friend and pastor. My life would not be the same without Kevin, and he opened doors for me that were very important. I was also remembering when he showed the pictures, the five of us, we've known each other since we were at least 18, those five guys, and when we get together, we still think that we're like young adults. And you didn't have to laugh at that, but you feel free. We'll often do one thing kind of unusual or out of the way. And a few years ago, we went surfing at Cowles Beach in Santa Cruz, California. We had two instructors, and one of them whispered to the other one kind of under his breath, "I guess it's AARP day at the beach today." So, yeah, I said, well, I guess it's not big tip today at the beach day. Anything's possible. Speaking of which, I sometimes think that we all have a word, some word or other, that most describes what we deeply hope is not true of us. I think most of us, if we were to sit down and talk together, there'd be some flaw or some trait that at some real deep emotional level we don't want to describe us, but we're afraid that it does. And for me, that word would be weak. I hate that word, weak. I have always admired fearlessness and strength of character, people who are courageously authentic, who bring to life a fighting spirit, who speak their minds boldly. I married somebody who's very much that way. And there's not much I hate more than the fear or yet worse than knowledge that I am weak. And partly that can be a physical thing. Some bodies are genetically pre-wired for strength. Some people are born to be wrestlers and football players. I was not. When I was a freshman in high school, I was 6 feet tall and I weighed 120 pounds and was untannable. One summer day, our high school group went to the beach and I took my shirt off and the comments were unpleasant enough that I decided I was not going through that again. In fact, one of the ways that I knew that Nancy was the person for me was the day that I thought, I think if I went to the beach with her, I could take my shirt off. For one thing, she's kind and would not humiliate me. For another thing, I think she genuinely kind of likes me. For another thing, we'd been married about 5 years by then and anything's possible. Strange thing, my weakness is real. I want to hide it. I want to pretend it's not there. But there's no healing in hiding. What if there was a place where we could go and reveal our weakness and inadequacy, and instead of shame, we would experience acceptance and healing and even some strength? So, gang, this is a message for weak people from a weak person. We mostly want messages that our abilities are remarkable, that our circumstances will get better, and that determination will always prevail. This is not that message. I will tell you up front, if your life is going great, your marriage is effort-free, they keep promoting you at work, Harvard is begging for your kids to apply, your cat is grateful and affectionate, strangers tell you you should be in an infomercial for how to get great abs, this message is not for you. But for the rest of us who live in a world where our family gets shattered, where a marriage crumbles, where the diagnosis is beyond hope, or disappointment in a friendship blindsides you, or no matter how hard you pray, you cannot make the anxiety or depression go away, or that hidden habit or secret addiction defeated you again yesterday, I want to invite you to join me in what might be called the Fellowship of the Withered Hand. I was first introduced to it 35 years ago. Another young pastor that I didn't know well, his name was Paul, and I had been invited to speak for 2 days to a small group of pastors in Ethiopia. At that time, Ethiopia was under a Marxist dictatorship. Colonel Mengistu, who would later be found guilty of genocide, of up to 2 million people, including the head of the Ethiopian Orthodox Church. Churches met underground in those days. Church leaders were often in prison. In fact, when I was there, we were told that the church folks referred to the prison as the university. Because when God wanted to grow somebody up, that's where they would end up. So those 2 days had an intensity unfamiliar to me. Paul and I took turns speaking for 90 minutes from early in the morning until bedtime in a cramped, crowded, sweaty room. And Paul spoke in the final session about a story told 3 times in the New Testament, focused on a man with a withered hand. And Paul's primary focus was on that man's weakness and inadequacy. We're not told whether the man was born this way or suffered some kind of injury. One ancient commentary says that he was a stonemason and so could not practice his trade. In Luke chapter 6, we're told it was his right hand that shriveled. And of course, in the ancient world, it was understood that would be the most important hand, the hand of agency, the hand that made work possible. Possibly he was a beggar. Possibly no woman would marry him. He was attending a synagogue, a place of worship, so he was a person of faith. He knew the stories in the Bible of healing. Anything's possible. There's even one in an Old Testament book, 1 Kings, about a man having a useless, shriveled hand restored. Why not him? He had surely prayed for this. Nothing. Most of the people who receive healing in the New Testament come to Jesus and ask. A leper, a man with an epileptic son, a man named Bartimaeus who shouts so loudly that the people tell him to shut up. The man with the withered hand did not ask. We don't know why. Maybe he was being polite. Maybe he was shy. Maybe he doubted. Deformity in the ancient world always came with a stigma, as being differently abled still does today. Very powerful book just called Stigma by a sociologist named Eric Goffman about 60 years ago. Maybe God was punishing him. I imagine him sitting there hiding his shriveled hand in his robe. It was his shame. He hoped nobody would notice. And then somebody did, and that somebody was Jesus. And in Luke chapter 6, verse 8, Jesus says, "Get up and stand in front of everyone." Not just get up, not even get up and stand. Get up and stand in front of everyone. In other words, expose your shame. Reveal the ugliness that you want to hide. Jesus deliberately calls him to do this. And the man sits for we don't know how long with his lifeless hand twisted inside his sleeve. And then the text says, so he got up and stood there for we don't know how long. So you have to enter into this moment. Everybody is staring at this man, at his hand. Worst, the people he most wanted not to be there are there. Healthy-handed religious people with strong right hands. They used to greet each other and do important work and shake their healthy right index fingers at the sinners and the shamed. A service of worship was the last place that he would want to expose this. And of course, Jesus knew this. Jesus knew all about how religion, quite orthodox faith, can often wither people's hearts and make them exclusive and judgmental and unloving. And even here, many of the leaders that were the religious leaders would be opposed to Jesus helping this man because it was the Sabbath and they valued rule keeping above people helping. One of the versions says this made Jesus deeply indignant. And then Jesus spoke a second time to the man, but now for the man, things got worse. He said, stretch out your hand. And of course, this was the one thing that the man with the withered hand would most want not to do. You don't go to a place of worship to expose what you're most ashamed of. That's the last thing you do. Not just that, this was the one thing that the man with the withered hand could not do. See, he had tried a million times. A child could do it, not him. His will was somehow unable anymore to make the neurons fire. Our bodies will do things like that to us sometimes. Jesus drew attention to that man's shame and weakness, for it was the man's weakness that would become the hinge of his story and the turning point of his life. He was not asked to do what he could. He was asked to do what he couldn't. And he must have thought to himself, my whole life has been centered around managing my withered hand, covering it up, keeping it hidden, all undone. This is the worst moment of my life. Until it wasn't. When I was in Ethiopia over and over and over in that hot, dark, sweaty, crowded room, Paul kept saying, Jesus asked the man to do the very thing the man could not do. Stretch out your hand. And so it is with us, Paul said. What God asks us to do, what we know we should do, is precisely what we are unable to do. And it was so striking. Paul did not try to inspire the people in that room by praising their strength. He did not say, you can defy Mengistu, you can withstand persecution, you can overcome poverty, you can save a country, you can do it. What he said was, Jesus is asking you to do what you cannot do. Stretch out your hand. And then something happened. And the leaders in that room began to cry. And they began to pray. They started to get up from their chairs and confess just spontaneously. Nobody asked them to do this. They talked about their fear of the government and being arrested. They talked about their jealousies of other people's ministries or churches or other people's families or their children or their bodies. They spoke of their deep inadequacy. They talked about their despair at their bickering little congregations. And somehow there was healing and recognition and hope and courage. And this went on deep into the night. They would not go home. In the States, that does not happen. Church service is over and people know you're supposed to leave. Leaving fast to beat the other cars and be the first one out of the parking lot. That's how you win at church. But they would not leave. And what came into that room what came into that room was power. What came was power, and we all knew it, but it did not come through giftedness or training or faith or inspiration or certainty, good as those things might be. It came in weakness. It came when people felt need and pain so great they had nothing to lose and nothing to hide. And the honest confession of ugliness and fear and sin and shame, it came to the fellowship of the withered hand. Paul and I talked about how the best things that happened on that trip happened more in spite of us than because of us. We had been asked by this church leadership group to smuggle in 50 large, expensive, illegal study Bibles for church leaders. This was way back before there were resources online like in our day. I was given an extra one before leaving home, so it was actually 51. When my plane was landed, I remembered I had never taken a class in smuggling while I was at seminary, and I got a little nervous. One suitcase full of Bibles was confiscated at the airport, and the leader of our group was summoned to the airport. The customs official took him into his office, closed the door, said they had found these illegal Bibles, and they would release them on one condition. The bribe he requested was that he, a Marxist customs official for a genocidal dictator, be allowed to keep one Bible for himself. After a year or so, Paul and I lost touch, but I've never forgotten his message and what happened that night. I have learned a lot more about this fellowship in the past few difficult years in my own life. And I was telling this story not too long ago to a small group of pastors in California, and one of them stopped me and said, "I know Paul. Paul has been my best friend for many, many years," and went on to tell me how Paul just recently had died, was at a gathering and tipped over in his chair and in a fluke accident fell backwards and broke his neck and died. And it made me wish I had been able to thank Paul for what I learned from him so many years ago. And made me grieve for his family and his church and the pain in a suffering world where there is so much that happens that I do not understand, where we are not in control of anything, not even of our lives sitting in a chair. And I wonder, when I think about this story, why did Jesus make the man stand up in front of everybody? Why not just heal him privately, offline, guard his dignity? Why make his weakness so transparent? And I think maybe a part of it, at least, is Jesus wanting to begin a new kind of community where people who are needy and broken and imperfect and deformed are particularly celebrated. Shame can be hidden or it can be healed, but it can't be both. So stretch out your hand. Years ago, I decided in my own life I would like to have a friend before whom I would have no secrets, no hidden shame or embarrassment. I had known my friend Rick for about 10 years at that point. I knew I could trust him. I asked him if he would be willing to hear my confession, and he said yes. And I spent several weeks getting ready, just looking back at my life and writing things down. And then I met with him, and it took probably a couple hours, and I told him all of these things that I most wanted not to tell anybody: my emotional life, relational, marriage issues, failures as a dad, sexual issues, financial failures, lies, cheating, jealousy. When I was done, I could not stand to look at him. And I will never forget what he said to me, because I wouldn't have predicted this in a million years. He looked me in the eye and he said, "John, I have never loved you more than I love you right now." And it felt so good, I wanted to make up more bad stuff just to know how much I was loved. And I learned that day, I can only be loved to the extent that I am known. I can only be loved to the extent that I'm known. And I can only be fully known if I can only be fully loved if I'm fully known. Because the soul is a whole thing, and I might be able to get you to say that you love me, but as long as there's something secret inside me, I'll say, "Yeah, but if you knew this." Rick and I have been friends for over 40 years now. We call each other every morning, Monday through Friday, as long as we're available, and talk for about 10 minutes. How did yesterday go? Temptations, failures, what are you facing today? A fully disclosing friend. Maybe you would like to ask God to help you find a friend like that. Now, it takes time. Don't go up to a stranger this morning and say, "Want to hear my darkest secret?" You have to get to know somebody and discern their character and build trust and find out if they have wisdom and they honor confidentiality and so. But I know that a church can't be the church when people are hiding. And maybe this is a day for you to stretch out your hand a little bit with a trusted brother or sister, maybe about a secret shame, maybe about something that needs healing. So interesting. I've been studying AA a lot the last several years. And as you may know, if you go to a meeting, then if you're going to talk, you start by saying, "My name is John, I'm an alcoholic," and everybody says, "Hi, John." My friend Mike says that in this fellowship, the worse your story, the warmer your welcome. Well, that'd be a cool thing to say about the church. There's a philosopher, Kent Dunnington, has a wonderful book called Addiction and Virtue. He says, one of the secrets in AA is that they have discovered that the recognition and public confession of inadequacy is itself a spiritual achievement that must be ritualized and celebrated. Let me say that again. They have discovered not just personal adequacy, the recognition and public confession of inadequacy is a spiritual achievement that must be ritualized and celebrated. So, Gateway, welcome to the celebration of personal inadequacy. The fellowship of the withered hand. My name is John. I'm a sinner. Okay, let's try that one more time. Here we go. My name is John. I'm a sinner. Thank you. I feel much more accepted. Here's the deal. That man had no idea that it was his weakness that would enable him to be part of a story that would be remembered and celebrated and inspire faith and hope 2,000 years later on the other side of the world. And I think that maybe another reason why this man's story went so public is that we are all really like him. It's just that some of us are better at hiding our withered hands or maybe denying them for many years. And for some reason, until we're driven to desperate need by our powerlessness or pain or brokenness, we're stuck with what only our own power can do. And we're not meant to live. You're not meant to live in your own power. This series is Anything's Possible. And as you might know, that actually comes from a statement of Jesus when he says salvation, rescue, deliverance, redemption, healing, rebirth is beyond the brightest and best of us, the most resourced of us. And his disciples wonder, well, then who can be saved? And Jesus says, with human beings, it is impossible. But with God, anything's possible. And in this series, you'll go on to talk about how anything's possible with God. But not yet. Because this week is the starting point. And the starting point is, with human beings, it is impossible. And that's why God says, my strength is made perfect in weakness. Part of why I am so grateful to be here is other really good friends, Doc and Barb and John, are here from the church that I first worked at starting 44 years ago, First Baptist Church at La Crescenta. When I was finishing going to grad school, I had to decide, should I be a therapist or a pastor? And when I was a therapist, I was not good at it. The more people would see me, the unhealthier they got. But I started to work at a church and preach sometimes when John would let me, and I just loved it. I felt so alive, and I thought, well, maybe this is what I'm called to. And then one Sunday, I was preaching, and the message was not going terribly well, and I started to feel kind of dizzy, and the next thing I knew, I had fainted dead away on the platform. My own sermon. And there was a lot going on. It was finals in grad school. I was about to get married. Nancy and I were going to be gone to Scotland for a year. So I thought, well, it's just kind of an unusual one-off. We were gone for a year. I came back the very next Sunday when I got up to preach. The next time, 1 year later, I fainted dead away again. And the worst part of it was that it was a Baptist church, not a charismatic church where you get credit for doing stuff like that. I was like, you know, you get brownie points for it. It wasn't that kind of a thing. And then that next week, John said, well, you're going to get up and preach again, and you're going to get up and preach again. If it kills you, you're going to... I asked God to take that away, that intensely uncomfortable feeling, and he did not. One of the things that I did that summer is I would just put a chair next to the lectern at that church, and when I felt like it might be coming on, I would just have to sit down so everybody would see my weakness. And of course, I could have embraced that, but I didn't. I didn't want it. I felt humiliated. I didn't want anybody to know. People would come and say, just have more faith, Pastor John. Just relax. And I formulated all kinds of non-faith-based responses when they would come and tell me things like that. And my text from that was one that I would need again in my life, where Paul says, he's got a thorn in the flesh, take it away, take it away, take it away. And God says no to that prayer, but he says, my grace is sufficient for you, and my strength is made perfect in weakness. And that was 40 years ago. I still get that feeling occasionally, not right now, so don't get so excited, but God has kept me upright now for 40 years. We live in a world of the withered hand. In our world, if there's any place that should be good news for the stigmatized and the marginalized and the differently abled and the oppressed, for those in the Bible who God cares about called aliens, immigrants in our day, the under-resourced, the undereducated, the other. If there's any place that ought to be good news for people like that, it's Jesus' church. And I don't know why we struggle with that so much. I don't understand it. But then let's get personal. What is your shriveled hand? What is the shame that you want to hide in song that inside that long sleeve in your robe? And the reason that we meet here, where anything is possible, is not first to fix it or solve it or even manage it. It's to name it, because something happens when people name it. I don't know why it is. I just know that it is. I used to think, without ever reflecting on it much, I can mostly do what needs to be done. I can do a job. I can grow an organization. I can raise a family. I can do the dad thing. I remember my boss, John, kind of warning me about the dangers of sufficiency when I was ordained many, many years ago. And eventually, mostly more recently, I've come to realize I can't. I can't fix my family. I can't fix my heart. I can't fix my anxious, resentful mind. I can't make my fear go away. I can't make my sadness go away. I don't mean I used to not be able to do those things, but now I'm strong and everything is okay, and I will share with you the secret. I mean, I cannot do it. So often in our lives, even sometimes in communities of faith, we think we have to come in power with a strong right hand. But it's not that way. You may know that the 12 steps from AA were taken from a Christian background, from a program of Christian discipleship called the Oxford Group. The first step is the recognition of personal inadequacy. Admitted that I was powerless over my problem and that my life had become unmanageable. And then the second one is a step of faith. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And then the third one is surrender. Made the decision to turn our lives and our wills over to the care of God. In AA, those three steps are sometimes summarized, I can't, God can, I think I'll let him. So if you carry nothing else away today, I'd love for you to carry those three phrases. Let's just say those out loud together. I can't, God can, I think I'll let him. What I can do is I can tell God the most important brokenness in my life, the most important difficulties that I face, the sin and the shame that I cannot forgive or heal. I can't. God can. That's where it starts. And somehow, finding other people in the same desperate condition, our mutual confessed, disclosed, inappropriate ways, weakness, releases a certain spiritual power that people who only come in strength and giftedness cannot know. I begin to discover my own little chapter of the Fellowship of the Withered Hand. So, what is your withered hand? Maybe your grief, maybe a loss, maybe your marriage, maybe your failure, maybe an addiction. Maybe you are old and you carry a desperate regret and you can't take it back. Maybe you are young and you've got a huge fear. Maybe you don't know if you're old or young, in which case you're old. Maybe it's a family that's such a tender place, and we all have scripts for how it's supposed to work. And none of us get that. When we had two children, we eventually had three, but when we had two, we were taking a cross-country flight one time, and they were, I think, 3 and 1.5, and we'd taken over the whole back row of the plane, and it was littered with dirty diapers and crackers and spilt milk and crumbs, and it didn't look good and it didn't smell good. You know you're in trouble when the flight attendant asks, could your kids play outside? And we were wondering, you know, why do we bring these kids with us? Why do we have these kids? And guy a couple rows in front of us turned back and looked and asked me, are those your children? And I thought about it and said, yes, they are. And he said, my wife and I would give anything in the world to have two children. And I said, oh, you don't have any children? He said, no, we have 5 children. We'd give anything in the world. And I, don't clap for that one. I don't know what the area is. I just know you got it. So I'm going to ask Tyler to come up. I got to wrap this up. But here's the invitation. Here's the word for today. Stretch out your hand. It's what a little child does. We have 2 little grandchildren, and that's about the most irresistible moment. A friend of mine put it to me like this. He said, when we had kids, I realized that I would kill for my kids. When we had grandkids, I realized I would kill my kids for my grandkids. And those little hands go up in the air. It's like, man, I'd do anything in the world to pick up that little body, help that little life. And Jesus would say over and over and over again, that's the heart of the Father. That's why anything's possible. But it starts, you know, not when you generate all kinds of willpower and certainty and muster up giftedness, and it doesn't start there. It starts here. Stretch out your hand. Gateway. For the fellowship of the withered hand turns out to be the fellowship of the empty tomb. And evil cannot silence it. And death cannot stop it. And it is still receiving applicants. And I hope you will be one. Stretch out your hand.